It's the 2012 Summer Olympics. They've begun. So we're going to get real competitive with our recommendations today. I'm Brian.
I'm Bill.
Christelle.
This is Amanda.
And Lisa.
And my favorite Olympic sport is biathlon, but that's a winter sport. So I'm going to have to put all my money on boxing. There were a lot of jokes in that line packed in that one sentence. But seriously, I'll be rooting for Sarah Robles, who's the highest ranked American weightlifter, even amongst men or women, right? But she couldn't get a sponsor to send her to the Olympics because nobody cares about women's weightlifting, which is weird because she can outlift all the men in America. She's got to win the gold medal. Could you please give her some money so she can go win us a gold medal? But she got a sponsor. I don't know when the weightlifting bracket that she's going to be in is. So the Olympics start on the 27th, and this will post around the 1st of August. So good luck, Sarah. I hope you win a gold medal. So, but there'll be stuff happening at the library, too, in August, which Bill will tell us about.
Yes, please come to the public library Saturday, August 11th, 2 p.m. in our main auditorium when we conclude our summer series with The Brinks Job, directed by William Friedkin. It stars Peter Falk, Peter Boyle, and Alan Garfield. This comic caper is based on an actual Brink robbery. Some of the actual robbers worked as advisors on the film. I highly recommend it.
Hey, you're going to tell us sort of like about a documentary later where that same kind of thing actually happens,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, it's interesting. So something else that's happening in town here, this isn't a library event, but it's pretty cool. Killer Nashville, which is a really big mystery author convention, will be here August 23rd to the 26th. And that's, I think, at a fancy hotel on West End. You can go to their website, killernashville.com, to find out. So the headliners are CJ Box, Haywood Gold, and Peter Straub. Now, here's the difference between stuff that just happens and stuff that happens at the library. If you want to go to Killer Nashville and meet all these co-authors, you got to pay. I'm not going to say how much it is. You can go to the website, killernashville.com, and there's different tracks. Like, if you're a fan, you can go to the fan thing. You can be like, I want to write better thing, or you can do the I want to be published thing, you know, or I am a publisher and I want to, like, steal your books to make money for me thing. That's all there if you want to do it. Killer Nashville. KillerNashville.com. Some other cool stuff that's happening at the library are, someone tell me.
Concerts in the Courtyard.
Concerts in the Courtyard, which is one of our most popular events. They start in August. First one is August 14th. It is the...
Wanna Beatles.
Sorry. Just one of the Beatles.
They've never read The Metamorphosis, or they would just have a different name. a terrible book joke.
Don't want to be.
I'm going to library hell for making that joke. But okay. But first, Olympics. And then, hey, when we're done, we're going to tell you what's tickling our fancy besides watching weightlifting on TV.
So I don't have an Olympics-related recommendation, but I happen to adore an animated film which does involve cycling. The 2003 film Triplets of Belleville tells the story of Madame Souza, her grandson Champion, and their hefty hound Bruno. Madame has acted as Champion's caregiver and trainer, preparing him for the most prestigious race in cycling. You know what that is. Champion may have been on his way to winning the Tour de France when he's kidnapped by French gangsters to be used in a gambling scheme. As Madame Souza and her beloved pooch, Bruno, head out on a mission to rescue Champion, they find help from the Belleville sisters, an aging but still spry and sassy song and dance team. In a percussive performance to rival the Blue Man Group, the Belleville sisters play a song using a newspaper, refrigerator, and vacuum cleaner, with guest musician Madame Souza playing a bicycle spoke drum. The Triplets of Belleville is nostalgic, satirical, as well as crude, and maybe even weird. But writer and director Sylvain Chomet loves his characters and never lets anything bad happen to them. And there's no dialogue to speak of, so don't worry about it being a French film. The animation has a depth and artistry that no recent animated film, I'm talking to you, Disney, has achieved. If you see it once, you'll want to see it again to catch all the things you missed the first time. And there are lots of little details to see. And so, Amanda, your sportish-related recommendation?
I'm going to move us a little closer to the Olympics. I'm not going to quite get there. I'm going to talk about 2004's tennis movie set in London. So, see, we're getting there. It's sooner. It's in the right city. But it's called Wimbledon, starring Paul Bettany and Kirsten Dunst. This is one of my favorite movies of the last, I guess, decade. It's been, I can't believe it's been 2004 since that came out. Basically, what the premise is Paul Bettany is kind of an over-the-hill, which means he's probably our age, tennis player.
Hollywood over the hill.
Yeah. Who has kind of slipped in the rankings. This is going to be his last Wimbledon. He's going through, you know, playing matches, and he keeps winning. And he accidentally bumps into Kirsten Dunst's character, who she's this American phenom who's kind of like one of the Williams sisters, but a little smaller, a little paler. And so they kind of strike up this relationship, and so the movie kind of explores that on top of this tennis and kind of, it's really witty and it's well written, and Paul Bettany has kind of this snarky British narrator character that he does over the top. He's the narrator of the movie on top of a lot of the scenes that I just think it's really well written and really, really enjoyable. But nobody really dies in the movie, so
way to ruin it.
I'm sorry. I know
spoilers.
It's more of a date movie.
I was waiting for someone to.
He has a powerful serve.
That is true. He does kill with the serve. But if you're looking for something a little bit darker, a little bit more serious, maybe Bill's take here will be more up your alley.
Bill here, and I want to talk about the 1999 documentary One Day in September, which deals with probably one of the darkest days in Olympic history. It deals with the Black September, a Palestine terrorist organization who during the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich kidnapped and murdered 11 Israeli athletes. The documentary interviews various people who were involved with the event at the time. This includes the widow Anki Spitzers, whose husband Andre Spitzers was one of the victims. He was a fencing coach for the Israelis. Also, the sole surviving terrorist, Jamal al-Ghazni, who is, shall we say, very unapologetic for his acts. I've always said I thought a movie should be engrossing rather than entertaining, or I prefer that. One Day in September is just that. The movie is a tragedy. First of all, 11 Israeli athletes who lost their life. And the other tragedy was the bureaucratic incompetence of the German police. For example, the German police were going to go in and charge and try to save the athletes. First off, the German police were untrained for this type of maneuver. And however, when they were about to do it, they called it off at the last second, which was good because the terrorists knew what the German police were doing. Now, you're probably saying, well, how did they know that? Because the terrorists were watching them on the television set as they were moving in. So there are many jaw-dropping moments like that. And if it wasn't, you know, it has this very dark, humorous side, I guess. But it's just this whole bureaucratic snafu that was going on at that time at many levels. One Day in September won a well-deserved Oscar for Best Documentary, and the movie was directed by Kevin MacDonald. I highly recommend it. And, Brian, you've kind of got a part two of this movie.
I do kind of have a part two. I just want to say, too, is like you don't want to give so much away, but it's one of those documentaries where truth is stranger than fiction. And even if you were alive in 72 when that happened, it's just – the stuff that this movie reveals will just totally blow your mind. It's totally engrossing and intense, and it's a movie that you won't forget. I mean, even the so-called humorous parts. It's like a farce of death. It's I don't even know, right? It's bizarre. But a little lighter, okay? Terry Gilliam, right? He's getting interviewed on AMC one time. Now, follow me here. You're like, what the talking about, right? So he's getting interviewed on AMC, and he says, he said, I'll tell you what I don't like about Steven Spielberg. He's like, when you watch a Steven Spielberg movie, you get all the answers. Like, you know, he tells you how you're supposed to feel. And sure, you might feel that way at the end, but, like, it's like you don't really go on the journey yourself. He's like, what I like about Stanley Kubrick, right, is that you don't get the answers. You got to think about the answer, you know? He's like, I saw 2001, you know what I mean? And I'm still thinking about what that movie means. So, like, with Spielberg, he's like, I know exactly what I'm supposed to think at the end. He's like, that's not as fun. So I thought to myself, well, is that true about Spielberg? It was right about, you know, Christmas time, War Horse was coming out. And I was like, yeah, that's true. We didn't expect that we were supposed to feel. But then I thought about it some more, and I was like, what about Munich? You know, the Steven Spielberg movie. And Munich was about, or supposedly about, the clandestine Israeli assassination force that went after the terrorists who got away, the members of Black September who got away with or at least survived or got out of East Germany. You have to watch One Day in September before, right, to really get a good picture. Who, like, you know, who got away without really any legal consequences, okay? So the lead, like, Israeli special agent is Eric Bana, and one member on his team is Daniel Craig, and I'll get to him a little later. But the big question that it asks is, you know, was it right for him to do this? And at the beginning, Eric Bana's character, who goes by Avner, which is a code name, you know, he thinks it's really right. Like, we have to get revenge on these people and what they did. And then to the next years of his life, he sacrifices everything in his life to go on these revenge killings with another team of, you know, agents. And it's way James Bond, except more real life. So it's almost like another farce of death. It's like, if these things really happened, you just, I can't believe it, right? Like, if you're going to hire a bomb expert, if you're going to hire someone to be your bomb expert, like, hire someone who's a bomb expert, right? Right? It's just as one example. You know, so slowly, though, he comes to a different moral place where he's like, you know what, these revenge killings, these were not right. Like, this destroyed my soul doing this. And, of course, officially within the movie, the Israeli government, you know, just denies all knowledge. And he said, hey, we're going to ask you to do this. They know it was a suicide mission. They knew it was going to take, you know, take his life away if he chose to do it, right? So then, you know, that maybe that wasn't the right thing to do to another person, to send them on a mission that they knew that was going to, like, tear up his life. And then they were going to not, no matter what happened, right, they were going to deny all knowledge, even though he went around the globe assassinating people, like, with no support of a government behind them. So it's just really seriously intense. And all sorts of moral questions occur. So it's, like, the exact opposite of what Gilliam says about Spielberg. But it was written by Tony Kushner, who wrote Angels in America, which is, I think, another, like, if you haven't seen that, I just go see that. I would get that. I think the library has that. Get that right now. I wrote Angels in America, which all sorts of moral questions are involved. They'll still have you thinking for years. So Munich, right, a good one, too. I think those are the heavies, right? And
what about that movie with William Holden where it was about, does anybody remember that?
Yes, that was a TV movie.
I thought that's what you were talking about, and I thought that's what you were talking about. And then I'm like, where's William Holden?
Well, so they made a TV, I can't remember, I just kind of assumed the library didn't have this, so I didn't bring it up. But they made a TV movie about this, too. And it was based on the book Vengeance, the True Story of an Israeli Counterterrorist Team. Now, this is written by a Canadian journalist, and he claims that he interviewed the real-life person that the Eric Bana character is based on. To this day, the Israeli government is like, no, that didn't happen. And that person is a real-life person who now, like, owns, like, a high-dollar security firm in New York, right? So, he's a real-life person who says, yeah, I was that assassin. But, I mean, but officially, right, I mean, this never happened. But there's been a book and two movies. You know, I guess you have to decide for yourself, right, whether this really happened. Now, the movie that Bill talked about is a documentary. It's about, and it's amazing, you know. So, I mean, you just kind of have to decide. I guess one of the even moral issues, too, is, like, if this was secret, was it moral for him to go public? I mean, you kind of get the idea that maybe he went public because he had so much at what he thought was a just mission, and then later he wasn't sure. And I don't think it's even resolved whether he thinks it's, you know, whether he... the Avner himself seems confused as to whether he should have done that. So seriously intense. So one of the other members on the team, just to bring this back maybe a little lighter, was Daniel Craig, was another one of like the Israeli Special Forces team. And there's this really intense scene where they get into a fight about like who's more dedicated to the mission. And they have this standoff, and they sort of get to this place where, like, well, I love Israel more than you do, and, you know, I'm more Jewish than you. And the more, like, it's funny because they zoom in on Daniel Craig, right, who doesn't, like, if you know, stereotypically look Jewish at all, pale blue eyes, blonde hair, right? And it's I had never seen him in a movie before. And, you know, his eyes, there's no one like his eyes, right? And he has that Marble Man face. And they just zoom in. And it's basically him having a stare down with Eric Bana is, I am more fanatically patriotic, and I will kill anyone and do anything and go anywhere to accomplish this mission than you. And it's just the camera's just on him. And, like, I had never seen Daniel Craig in a movie before. And I was just like, wow. Right? And there is this really interesting racial thing that's happening, too, because, like, he doesn't seem Jewish. But he's like, I will do anything for this. So, you know, there's that aspect there. And then, of course, after that, he started getting roles. Like, he was cast as James Bond. And I was like, huh, I wonder, right? You know, he was the special agent. He was really intense and handsome and suave. And then after that, too, I think in the same vein, he got cast as Lord Asriel in the Golden Compass adaptation, which I thought was, like, perfect casting. And Nicole Kidman, I think, was perfect casting in that movie, too. And
And I
didn't see it. I mean, I liked the first book, the Golden Compass was good, but I didn't like the other books. But then, of course, he also, like, this year he got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is probably really, so, like, this dude's everywhere. He was in Cowboys and Aliens, the new James Bond, Skyfall's coming out this fall. So this is the first time I had seen him in a really intense role. So that's what I got. Now, I want to apologize that me and Bill went so dark. But I think we both kind of looked at each other just like, well, if we're going to talk about the Olympics, right, these are like the two movies that we can't. If we're supposed to be like, here's some, you know, recommendations for some good movies. And I can remember back, I mean, a few weeks ago, Amanda had talked about the Chris Kyle biography, American Sniper, who was the most successful sniper. And I almost said something to you after. I was like, you know, that was a little dark for the podcast. You know, I was like, maybe you don't want to. But then, of course, until you wear the jacket, then it's just like, well, hey, I had to, right? I had to go there, so.
But I would say that I was trying to find a good summer Olympic movie. And I mean, there's a lot of Winter Olympic movies, like with the hockey and, you know, the Miracle on Ice and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, name a Summer Olympic movie. Ready, go.
Chariots of Fire.
I was going to say, Bill came up with that the other day. That's the only one I can think of.
Well, then Cool Runnings has a part that's set with track and field in the Summer Olympics. But I mean, even it's a bobsled movie, too.
Yeah.
What about that movie about that guy whose heart exploded?
Yeah, there's two pre biopics, Steve Prefontaine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's, was like the original like American bad dude, but every time he went to the Olympics he burned himself out because he refused to like pace himself. Like he would always overtrain and just
and his himself. Heart exploded.
Yeah, and eventually, yeah, that did happen. But when he was at the Olympics, right, he would run too hard and burn himself out. So there's a lesson there. And his coach founded the Nike Corporation.
Dang.
Yeah, he did.
He doesn't have to work. He's good.
Well, you know what? I believe he's dead now.
He really doesn't have to work.
But for many years, he didn't have to work. But he designed shoes for Steve, and those shoes became the Nike Corporation. And because I'm unprofessional, I forgot his name.
It wasn't Nike.
There was also a movie Steve in Nike. The early 70s called Games, which dealt with the marathon of the Olympics and early role for Ryan O'Neill, but it was written by Eric Segal, who went on to write Love Story.
Yeah.
Just kind of, I've only seen it once on a television back in the early 70s. And
but the real star of the Olympics, it's Bob Costas, right? Is that?
I mean, he's going to be on TV for like 4 weeks straight.
And so. I mean, maybe someone can correct me on this.
That doesn't sound like an Olympic movie, Bill. Is that what you're talking about?
No.
We've gone to the iPhone. I think we need to narrate what's coming.
We can't put your iPhone
through the speakers.
That's fact-checking. 21st century.
That's right. We fact-check in real time.
There is a...
He's like, that's not it. Look at Brian O'Neill's IMDb.
Pretty good flick.
Wait,
but you can have two titles.
This side of the table is really confused.
Wait, can I link to that in the show notes, whatever that movie was?
We might have to strike it.
I doubt we haven't. Sorry.
So, what is tickling my fancy this month besides watching weightlifting on TV? A book, How to Build an Android by David F. Duffy. And I know I'm kind of stuck in a rut here, but it's about the guys who built the robotic head of Philip K. Dick that could talk. Do you guys remember this?
No.
So I don't remember this.
So back in 2005, a team of computer programmers and robot builders built the android of Philip K. Dick that you could have real conversations with. And it was amazing and creepy. It would follow you around the room. The two big players were David Hanson, who was the actual sculptor who could build the faces that look real. If you've ever seen videos on YouTube of, like, human faces that move, they're probably faces built by David Hanson. And then Andrew Olney, the computer programmer, who actually made the AI to make the language work. And he did this by he took the corpus of Dick's work and fed it into the computer and wrote programs to make him answer questions when you would talk to him. Totally amazing. And I think more amazing is they didn't do it at MIT. They didn't do it at Stanford. They did it at the University of Memphis, which admittedly does have a really awesome artificial intelligence center there, which I didn't know. And then also David Hanson actually cast the Philip K. Dick's head and the motors in his apartment in Dallas, right? And then literally before they were going to debut this at the Wired Next Fest, it was like the day before, they're like driving up with the head in the back of the truck and putting it together. Like they weren't sure it was going to work. I just don't want to give too much away. Truth is always stranger than fiction. If you're a Philip K. Dick fan, they have transcripts of some of the conversations that the android has. I mean, it will just totally touch your heart because the things that the android says sometimes are so insightful and ironic and appropriate. They built like a replica of Philip K. Dick's apartment. He's just sitting there on the couch, and you could walk in, and the android head would turn to you, and you would talk to it, and it would talk back.
That's insane.
You know, and it was like, and it was,
and
it
was, well, some people were really scared, right? But it said, you know, where are you? And he said, I'm here in my apartment, but it could be a simulacrum. It might not be real. And everyone, that just totally freaked everybody.
He knows he's not real.
Totally freaked everybody out. And then I guess, like I said, how do you start if you have no history of like building Android? How do you start? Well, you start with one of those singing fish that when you walk by, that's what you start with, right? So Olney started with one of these singing fish that he had in his garage, and then eventually that became the Philip K. Dick android. In true Philip K. Dick fashion, maybe the saddest, best part of this story, in between flights, the designer, David Hanson, left the robotic head on a plane, and it was never seen again. After it had become the talk of the internet. And of course, this totally just feeds into like the never ending Philip K. Dick mythos of like, you actually made an android of you, the most appropriate person on earth you'd ever make an android of. And in typical Philip K. Dick fashion, like the worn out, stressed out dude leaves it on a plane and then it disappears. And then the conspiracy theories start of what happens. I've heard that they actually have a new model that's even better than the old one, but I haven't got to the end of the book yet. When the book was started, the Philip K. Dick head was just...
It's probably down there at that unclaimed baggage store in Scottsboro. Did they check there?
He went there.
Just in case.
He went there, and he wasn't there. He looked for it.
He looked through all the stuff.
Hey,
is this my head?
No, that's not the right head.
Well, they're like asking about it.
It's a human head.
And it's like, well, what is it? Well, like, it's a human head. It looks super realistic, creepily real, and it has wires coming out of the back of it.
Well, they found that Hoggle. They have the Hoggle from
Like, it's one of those things where if they had it, like, you know what I mean? It would be under glass, right, even if they found it. Well, like, what could be in the warehouse? Can I go in the warehouse? No.
Aww.
So, but he leaves this. you know, well, what is it, you know, whether you're looking for? If we find it in the warehouse, we'll let you know. But I think it's actually where this head is. Amanda had reviewed the book about the art detectives.
Oh, yeah.
And what's the one thing that you do? If you're going to steal something, do not steal the famous piece. Yeah. You know, like if you steal like the coolest thing that was ever invented in the history of science fiction, you're not going to be able to sell it on eBay.
But you can hoard it in your basement and go down and play with it every
That's
now
That's terrifying to think about. Somebody has it in their basement.
You know what totally would happen? Some guy has pajamas on and goes down and like, are you doing so?
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's probably on drugs and he uses it as an oracle.
What should I do today, Phil?
God, so, anyway. So cool. How to Build an Android, The True Story of Philip K. Dick's Robotic Resurrection by David F. Duffy. Go Tennessee, University of Memphis. I love it.
All right. How do you follow that?
I know. Was a really, I'm sitting here thinking about the head.
I got nothing. No, I actually got something. I'm reading a book called Those Across the River. It's by first-time novelist Christopher Buhlmann. Set during the Great Depression, former professor Frank Nichols and his soon-to-be wife Eudora move from Chicago to a small Georgia town called Whipbrow. They're going to live in a house that Frank's aunt left him. They've left academia because Frank was getting it on with Dora, and she was married to one of his colleagues. But this is going to give Frank an opportunity to write the history of his family's old plantation and the atrocities that occurred there. Now, at first, this small Georgia town seems perfect, but of course, there's an unspoken evil the townsfolk have lived with for generations that comes from the woods, there's the title, across the river, where the ruins of the plantation still stand. And I'm about halfway through. It's really great, and there's no holds right now, so
you
request
could be
it. You could be next. What are you reading or?
Have read. Just finished, actually. And I have to apologize because I promised I was going to read the next Diana Gabaldon over vacation, and I didn't get to it because it's too big. But I did read this one called The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbery. It's French, and I wish her name was Frencher, but that's okay. I thought it was going to be my book club picked it, and I thought it was going to be this book I was going to have to slog through. I kind of picked it myself, but I still thought it was going to be this book that I had to slog through, and there was going to be some morally redeeming thing I was supposed to care about, kind of like Steven Spielberg movies that I didn't want to care about. But it wasn't, and it was engaging, and it was very well written. There are two main characters. One is a 50-something older French lady who works as the concierge in this high-end apartment. She's kind of dumpy, kind of not. She was married, but her husband's passed away. He got cancer and was sick, so she's all alone in this. She has a cat. And then there's this little girl who, I believe she's 12, going on 13, and she has decided on her 13th birthday that she's going to commit suicide because there's no reason to live, because no one appreciates her. She's very intelligent, and like her parents just kind of brush her off, and no one really, and she can't figure out a reason why she needs to continue living. And so a lot of the book is like the thoughts of the older lady compared, you know, looking back on her life, and the younger girl trying to figure out a reason to not kill herself. And it's very interesting. A lot of philosophy. I don't read philosophy, but it was still interesting. And maybe it's because I spend so much time in my own head, I thought it was really interesting. But it just engrossed me. And there's a big heart underneath it. I'm not going to give you any more of the plot. My favorite part of the book, though, was, you know, you're reading a good piece of literature when a 50-year-old, kind of, you know, middle-class-ish white woman in France starts quoting an Eminem song. And I was just, I was reading, and it's not like, you don't get the lyrics or anything. Like, she just starts writing out the lyrics. Like, this lady's thinking about this, and I was like, wait, I know that song. That's Eminem. And then, like, she goes on in the text to say, and I just had to laugh. I'm like, that is just so hilarious that, and I'm sure Eminem would probably not think he was that heavy to be that ubiquitous that they would quote him in France. But, so if you're looking for just a good, solid read, Elegance of a Hedgehog, it's actually the second book by the author. The first book was called Gourmet Rhapsody, and she actually features one of the characters. It's set in the same building, and you see, like, it features one of the other characters that you meet in the second book. That he's just kind of a side character in the second book, so I may go back and read that at some point, but it was very awesome, and I don't know who I'm passing to.
Lisa?
I think it's me.
Okay.
And I hate to go back to a dark subject since we already did the Munich thing at the beginning, but August 13th would have been Alfred Hitchcock's 113th birthday. And I thought, seeing as we've got a new movie coming out with, I think it's going to be Anthony Hopkins playing Alfred Hitchcock, and Janet Leigh is going to be portrayed by
Scarlett
Johansson, and Jessica Biel as Vera Miles, they're going to do a movie about the making of Psycho from 1960. And if you're interested in that subject, we have the book that it's based on, which is Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho by Stephen Rebello. One of the books that I was interested in that doesn't necessarily have to do directly with the production is called The Girl in Alfred Hitchcock's Shower, which was written by Robert Graysmith, the same journalist that worked on the Zodiac Killer mystery in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s. It's about Marley Renfro, who is a nude model that stood in for Janet Leigh during some of the more racy, for 1960, shower scene moments. And there was actually some controversy after she was a nude model for Playboy and some gentlemen's magazines in the 60s, and then disappeared or was not heard of for a while there, and it was thought that she might be the victim of an Ed Gein copycat-type killer. So Robert Graysmith got really interested in trying to track her down to see if she was still alive or what exactly happened in the 60s. And it's got some insight, again, into the production at the beginning, but then more goes into the whole mystery of it after that. So I thought that was interesting. We've also got Psycho, Behind the Scenes of a Classic Thriller, written by Janet Leigh for actual on-the-set little tidbits, and a DVD called The Psycho Legacy, which I haven't seen, but looked pretty interesting online, detailing different things that went on during the writing and the subsequent shooting of the movie. And that's all I got.
So I'm sure that a lot of this is covered in a lot of those books you talked about, but, you know, no studio would make that movie.
Well, the thing was, he made it, Shamley Productions did it, which is his own production company that did Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And he wanted to see, it was like an almost like an exercise to see if he could make a movie under $500,000 and with the same crew as his TV people. So it's black and white, that's very limited sets, and, you know, the crew was really skeleton crew.
He was influenced by Roger Corman. He wanted to do a Roger Corman movie.
And I guess it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. Does this Anthony Hopkins, Scarlett Johansson movie come out? Is that
it's in production now, but they've released some of the stills, and it's really bothering me how much they say he looks like him. And I'm like, well, he's got the prosthesis on, but that's right. Just about it. It looks like Anthony Hopkins dressed up like Alfred Hitchcock.
I guess I'll start this off with a question. What do Gary Cooper, Montgomery Clift, Sterling Hayden, Spencer Tracy, and Lee Marvin all have in common? Well, I'll tell you. They all kick the crap out of Ernest Borgnine on screen in various movies. And I want to do a little tribute to Ernest Borgnine. He was a personal favorite of mine. He died July 8th, 2012. He was 95 years of age. Mm. And he was a true working actor because he was still working right up until his death. But the reason why I've always had the Ernest Borgnine theory that they always got Ernie Borgnine to play the villain because he was so good at it that he always made the leading actors look well when they kicked the crap out of him on screen. Even in the movie Willard, when he was eaten alive by rats, you cheered for the rat. So
it's another
he
spoiler.
Could, yeah. So he was a great at playing villains, but then again, during the 60s, when I was first introduced to him, of course, was playing in McHale's Navy, which was a 30-minute sitcom, and he won his Oscar for a romantic lead in Marty. But he's had a long career, and he just wrote his autobiography just a couple of years ago, which we have in our collection called Ernie the Autobiography. And also just type in his name under author Borgnine Ernie, and, you know, I can highly recommend. You've probably seen these movies, but Emperor of the North Pole, which is one people don't know a lot about, I highly recommend. There's The Dirty Dozen, of course, Escape from New York, From Here to Eternity, Ice Station Zebra, Johnny Guitar, and SpongeBob and SquarePants. I mean, he's an eclectic, done a lot of work, TV, and still doing high-quality work. And sometimes you think about meeting somebody, and you probably think, well, you probably don't want to but I always kind of thought I would like to meet Ernest Borgnine because he seemed like a generally nice guy. And it's just, man, so much of my life, when I was going to the movies or watching television, he was just a mainstay. So I just wanted to do a tribute to Ernest Borgnine. And once again, just look in the library catalog. We have a lot of his films.
Emperor of the North, that's the one that, if you haven't seen it, that I would recommend, right?
Greatest fight scene in the history of the movies. And Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine. No, none of that CGI crap. They're on the back of that train, and they look like they're going at it.
Exactly, yeah. And we've talked a little bit about Lee Marvin on the show before, so if you want to see the best fight scene ever with Ernest Borgnine and Lee Marvin, Emperor of the North, for
none
sure.
None of this sped-up crank hammer crap. None of that.
No wires, no floating.
I mean, they're on the back of that train. No back, you know, they're really going at it. It looks like it's great. My aunt almost threw up when she took me to the movie. But
like, don't embarrass me by throwing up. This is awesome.
Nice tribute, Bill.
Thank you.
This became a really dark podcast.
It's summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Peter
summer.
Peter O'Toole retired, so he's going to be writing his memoirs, right?
Yeah. He already wrote the first part, Lottering with Intent. Yeah, he's probably the second, third part.
I thought it was interesting last year how Ernest Borgnine and Eli Wallach, they're the same age, were both in major motion pictures. Yeah. I can't remember what Ernest Borgnine was in, but Eli Wallach was in Money Never Sleeps, that Wall Street sequel. And he's still, again, just perambulating. I can't believe that.
Well, Ernest Borgnine, I think he might be talking about Red. He was in this movie with Morgan Freeman and Richard Dreyfuss. Maybe. Big summer movie, but Helen Mirren was in it. Who Helen Mirren plays Alma Hitchcock in the new Hitchcock.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
She's a little tall for that.
Oh, what you learn in the podcast.
That's why I listen every month.
I hate the internet. Sorry. But I was trying to see, do we still have a copy of The Ruling Class?
I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, I bet we don't.
We might be out in Branchland.
It is weird what'll turn up at like Evans and Pike. You're like, what do you mean it's out there?
Send it to Luby, seriously.
Hail Mary, right? Good Peter O'Toole movie, probably my favorite, The Ruling Class. I guess Lawrence of Arabia too. That's a pretty good movie.
I gotta throw in The Stunt Man. I don't know if we have it in the collection, but that's a personal favorite of mine.
That's good. I'm trying to think.
Not to steal the thunder from Ernest Borgnine.
Oh, that was a happier note. He's still alive.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Popmatic Podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.